Hare Krishna. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Thank you. So this morning we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 1, the first step in God realization. These texts are dealing with the universal form. And text number 27 and 28. So we'll chant 27. Dve Januni Sutalam Vishvamurtir. Urudvayam Vitalam Chatalam Cha. Mahitalam taj jagyanam mahipate. Nabastalam navi suro grananti. Ture januni sutalam vishvamurte. Urudvayam vitalam chattalam cha. Mahitalam taj jananham mani mahitalam taj jahanam bi mahapati. Nabastalam nabi suro grananti. Januni sutalam vishvamurter. Urudvayam vitalam chatalam cha. Mahitalam taj jahanam mahipate. Nabasutalam nabisuru grananti. Okay, word meanings. Dve two, Januni, two knees, Sutalam, the planetary system named Sutala, Vishvamurte, of the universal form, Uru Dvayam, the two thighs, Vitalam, the planetary system named Vitala, Cha also, Atalam, the planets named Atala, Cha and, Mahitala, Mahitalam, the planetary system named Mahitala, Tat of that, Jaghanam, the hips, Mahipate, O King, Nabas, Talam, outer space, Nabi Sara, the depression of the navel, Granti, they take it so. Translation, the knees of the universal form are the planetary system of the name Sutala, and the two thighs are the Vitala and Atala planetary systems. His hips are Mahitala, and outer space is the depression of his navel. Text number 28, the chest of the original personality of Godhead, the original personality of the gigantic form, is the luminary planetary system. His neck is the Mahar planets, his mouth is the Janas planets, and his forehead is the Tapas planetary system. The topmost planetary system, known as Satyaloka, is the head of he who has 1,000 heads. We have a volunteer to read a short purport today. Yes?
The effulgent luminary planets, like the sun and the moon, are situated almost in the mid-place of the universe, and as such they are to be known as the chest of the original gigantic form of the Lord. And above the luminary planets, called also the heavenly places of the universal directorate demigods, are the Mahar, Janas, and Tapas planetary systems, and above all the Satyaloka planetary system, where the chief directors of the modes of material nature reside, namely Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva. This Vishnu is known as Shirodakshayi Vishnu, and he acts as the supersoul in every living being. There are innumerable universes floating on the causal ocean, and in each of them the representation of the Virat form of the Lord is there, along with innumerable suns, moons, heavenly demigods, Brahmas, Vishnus, and Shivas, all of them situated in one part of the inconceivable potency of Lord Krishna, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 10:42.
Thank you. Om Ajnana Timarandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunvitam Yena Tasmay Shri Gurave Namaha. So this description of the universal form of the Lord goes on for several verses, and I would encourage you to at least read through the end of the chapter to get a complete description, as I'm not sure that all of your classes will cover that. You're going on break or something, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everyone likes it. Yeah, everyone likes a break. But today we're going to talk about something I think that applies to all those verses as well, and that is the subject of inconceivability. Because as described here in the last sentence of the purport, all of them are situated in one part of the inconceivable potency of Lord Krishna, as stated in Bhagavad Gita 10:42. It's interesting because on Sunday at the temple, I was speaking on 10:41. And so the next class, and 10:42 is the next class. Now, both of those verses are concluding verses in the Bhagavad Gita, describing the opulences of the Lord. So many different ways in which the unlimited potency of the Lord is represented in this world. And so certainly the universal form is one of them. But I think the essential point is the inconceivability of the Lord. And that's what we want to talk about today. Three parts about it. What is it, first of all? How to understand it? And three, being tested by it. It being the inconceivability of the Lord. Now, doesn't that seem like a little contradiction? We're talking about what's inconceivable. We're talking about how we can understand it. It's kind of like an oxymoron. You can't understand something that's inconceivable. Otherwise, it's not inconceivable. But that's kind of the inconceivable nature of Krishna consciousness. Somehow or another, we can talk about the inconceivable. But I want to start with a little story just to emphasize how important this is. How important this idea of approaching the inconceivable is. I mean, we could just say it's inconceivable and leave it, but that's not going to be good enough. And there's a little story about Srila Prabhupada that exemplifies this. Back in 1972, at the time when Krishna Conscious Movement was really just starting to grow, a lot of people joining. Of course, it had been established for many years, starting in 1966, but really by 72 it was, you know, a robust organization. And so Srila Prabhupada was in Los Angeles, and many of the leaders had come there for a meeting, and there was a big sannyas initiation. He did Undamaraj took sannyas at that time. Satrup Maharaj took sannyas at that time. It was in May of 1972. And all the GBC leaders of the society were there. So Prabhupada called them all to his garden. He had a small garden there in Los Angeles. It's still there. And he asked them a question. So I want to read to you an account of one of the people, the leaders that was there at that point, just to give you the question Prabhupada asked. So Jagadish was saying, Prabhupada had all the GBC men come to Los Angeles, where some of them took sannyas, and we discussed reapportioning preaching zones. We had one special meeting with Prabhupada. All the GBC men were sitting there in the room, and Prabhupada looked us all over. He said, "Are you all convinced?" We just sat there. Nobody said anything for about 2 minutes. That's a long time. It was one of the heaviest moments of my life, Prabhupada challenging us, "Are you convinced? Are you sincere?" As Prabhupada spoke, his GBC disciples listened intentively. "As far as I am concerned," he said, "I am convinced. Therefore, I am pushing on. It is a fact. I'm pushing on because it is fact, not fiction. That much I am personally convinced. Whenever someone says, 'You believe?' I say, 'No, I do not believe. It is fact.' So you must spread your conviction by your literature, arguments, preaching, facing opposing elements. But are you convinced? If you are not convinced, then it is not good for me. The first thing is enthusiasm. Don't be dead. You have to work more than me. Anyone who has life, he can preach." So Prabhupada was challenging the devotees on this point. I mean, who is not convinced by prasadam, like we talked last time, or the nice lifestyle that we lead? I mean, that's how we're convinced. But there's a lot about Krishna consciousness that is inconceivable. And so the question is, are you convinced of these things? How to be convinced of these things? I'm not saying that I'm convinced, but I'm a little convinced, and I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to tell you why I'm a little convinced. And it has to do with a snowball fight. Has anybody ever been in a snowball fight here? Alakant has been in a snowball, okay. So, huh? Sand fight, okay. That's because you're from Florida, you know. But I was in a snowball fight once. It was when I was a temple president. Now, I don't know if they were getting back at me or what, but somehow or another, the snowball fight started. It was in Washington, D.C. And at one point, a very, very skinny devotee, I thought he was a weakling kind of devotee, he picked up and made a snowball, and he threw it at me. And it really almost hit me in the face. It zipped past my head very quickly, I was surprised. I was shocked because he was at a distance from me. He was a little thin. I didn't think he was that strong. But he threw that snowball and zipped right by my head. I thought, whoa. This guy's stronger than I thought. And he was stronger than I thought because his build was slight. He didn't have big muscles or something like that. But he was exhibiting a strength that was beyond just his body, it seemed like. So I had the realization, actually, when that happened, that actually strength is not just a product of the bones and the mechanisms and the muscles in the body. Strength is something more than that. It's beyond that. Again, like I was talking on Sunday at the feast, I don't know how many of you were there, but we were talking about beauty and how beauty is not just a physical arrangement, but it's actually perceived as something more than the physical arrangement. So strength in this case was something more than the body could perceive. And I realized that actually it's inconceivable. Strength is inconceivable. We can't just think of it in terms of the throwing mechanism, the muscles, and the force and things like that, but it's something more. So I had this realization shortly after this snowball whizzed past my head. And it convinces me that there's something more than just this body, something more than just this body and the world we see around us, things that we can conceive. There's something more than that. There's an inconceivable element to this world and how things act in this world. Now, as I said, I'm not completely convinced because there's so much of that inconceivability there. But I think if we're going to progress in Krishna consciousness, we have to approach this subject matter and try to understand as much as we can about the inconceivable nature of the Lord. And so we're going to try to do that today. As I said, our first point is what is it? And we're going to turn to some guidance given to us by Srila Prabhupada in how to approach this subject of inconceivability. The first point is that inconceivability is by God, Krishna, by his very definition, is inconceivable. So if we're going to worship Krishna, we're going to be dealing with inconceivable. It's a definition. Inconceivability is a definition of the position of God. And here's something Srila Prabhupada said in that regard. We often wonder how these big planets are floating in the air. He's talking about universal form, same thing we're studying in these verses. We often wonder how these big planets are floating in the air. It is stated here that the Supreme Lord, by his inconceivable energy, is sustaining all these big planets and systems of galaxies. The word achintya, inconceivable, is very significant in this connection. God's energy is beyond our conception, beyond our thinking, jurisdiction, and therefore called inconceivable, achintya. So by his very definition, the very definition of God is he has to be beyond what we can conceive with our mind and senses. If he's not, then he's under our control. He's within our control to a certain degree. If we can conceive him, if all that we know of him is conceived by our mind and senses, then he's not really God. He's not really beyond our control. He's not the supreme controller. And so, by his very definition, he has to be beyond our reasoning power. Because that's how we understand the world, isn't it? Through our reasoning. A lot of you are scientifically studying science and things like that. So reason, observation, and making some conclusions based on the observation, these are how people attain knowledge in this world. It's how they understand everything. It's how they exhibit mastery over the control of this world. So if God is within that scope, then he is not truly inconceivable, and he can't be God. Indeed, Srila Jiva Goswami, one of our acharyas, he says that unless we accept this principle that God or Krishna is inconceivable or has inconceivable power, achintya shakti, that we cannot understand, unless we accept that fact, we'll never begin to understand Krishna. So the first step in understanding the inconceivable is to understand and accept that he is inconceivable, not that we can control him. Now, what group of philosophers think that they can control the inconceivable? Anybody? Gyanis? And gyanis ultimately come to what kind of conclusion? Bhakti, not bhakti. Yeah. Moksha, yeah. Liberation or an impersonal understanding. Right? They ultimately come to an impersonal understanding when they try to accept this fact that a God is inconceivable. Or they just feel that that's as far as they can go by their intelligence, by their analysis. That inconceivability, as described in the Vedic literatures, means an person, that God can't be a person. But for us, for Vaishnavas, personalists, the ultimate conception is God as a person, and he has unlimited potencies. He can do anything and everything that he wants. Anything and everything he wants. He's not limited by his body. And there's a statement to this effect that Prabhupada makes. I can read to you here. But those who are intelligent, they will stress inconceivable power. Just like we accept Krishna as God, inconceivable power. We accept Rama, inconceivable power. Not so cheaply. One rascal comes and says, I am incarnation of God. Another rascal accepts. It is not like that. And so, not only does this inconceivability define God's position, but it also points out those who would imitate God, who would claim that they are God. Because if someone claims that they are God, then they can be tested. They can be tested by us. Are you God? Can you display inconceivable potencies? If you can't, then you're simply a rascal, as Srila Prabhupada says here. So, how then do we understand God? Okay, we accept, you know, what it is. He's inconceivable. So how then do we begin to understand what is the inconceivable? Does anybody have a starting place that they'd like to put us?
I was actually thinking a little bit different. Mm-hmm. When we talk about conceiving, I mean, trying to understand someone, then we are on the mental platform, like action of someone whom we don't love. Then we try to conceive what was the motive, how he's thinking. But if you love someone, that the idea of whether he's conceivable or inconceivable just is removed from the two people.
Oh, that's interesting. All right, so then when one develops love for God, the whole idea of inconceivability is something that doesn't matter. You go beyond just, you know, accepting that as a definition of God, and love actually defines the relationship. That's good. We'll get back to that and how that's developed a little later. Yes?
By grace alone.
By grace alone. Very good. All right. Yes? By superior authorities. Mm-hmm.
Kalakan? Association of devotees.
Association of devotees. Okay.
Since we can't understand, we can't conceive that universal form of the Lord, shouldn't we try to be more personal with him and, get to know about his pastimes and, how he... how he does everything, I guess, in a more personal way, if you can't understand the unpersonal.
Right. No, no. That's very good. Very good. All these are good. Any more? Anybody has something? Go on.
Kind of how to explain it or whatever. You know, lots of people say, well, we'll never know, or we'll know when we die or something like that. Jiva Goswami says in Tattva Sandarbha that we'll never know everything at any point, because then our mind would be as big as God's.
Hmm.
And an idea to conceive of inconceivability or whatever, you probably heard similar stories. Like if there's a cockroach in this building or something, he might know a little bit about this building or the front porch or something. But how much does he know about the state of Florida or the world?
Hmm.
Nor does he have the capacity to understand.
Right. All these things, Arjuna, you have something? Okay. Now, all these things are very good, and I think that they are sort of crystallized in the statement about by grace alone and by, what did you say? Superior authority, yes. Superior authority. And love, also. That also came out in some of the discussion. Because that's a very important thing. Just we think back to that conversation in Prabhupada's garden in 1972. He was telling them, I'm convinced. And he said, not that I believe, it is fact, he said. Very, very strong statements by Srila Prabhupada. And that encourages all of us. It gives us the conviction. So very much a part of what all of you just said is the idea of this parampara system of great persons who accept. And Prabhupada says himself, even in the Gita itself, it says, Krishna says that in the past, and he lists several names of great personalities, that they accepted the truth of Bhagavad Gita, indicating to Arjuna that that is how you know the truth, at least it's a beginning point in how you know the truth, is by accepting what the great authorities and the acharyas in the past have said. That's why we worship the guru. That's why we worship the parampara, is because by their example, by their conviction, we become convinced of what is not understandable to us, what is ultimately inconceivable to us. So that's the first step in doing that. Yes, sir. Okay.
So this kind of like what you said, I was thinking about, like, this world around is inconceivable. There are many inconceivable things about this whole world, like how we came into existence, and there are many things we don't understand. So we can say that either what's the cause of that inconceivable? Is it just happening by chance, or is there some person behind it? There has to be someone. So if that someone is behind this inconceivable things, then he has to be inconceivable also. So based on that, we can accept, okay, like, I may not be able to understand, but I accept that there is person just beyond me. So on that, I accept. Yeah.
Good. That's a good step, first step in dealing with the section of what we're talking about today is how we understand. And so that's a good using your logic and reason to also try to get there. But Prabhupada gives some very interesting examples about how we can view even our own bodies as inconceivable. Right? Does anybody remember any of the examples he gives? How?
Yeah, digesting food.
Digesting food, right. How does it happen? Oh, you can. You can give us what they say, right? What is it? Is it? Okay, you can tell us a little bit.
Well, it goes down your esophagus, and it goes into your stomach,
mm-hmm.
and your stomach. It breaks it down, and then right after it goes into your ileum. And your ileum, there's bile salts from your liver. Your liver makes bile salts, and they're stored in the gallbladder. I could go on and on. And
please don't.
I understand the whole thing about the fire in your stomach, and I think there is a fire in your stomach. There's actually a chemical reaction going on in there. I mean, maybe this is wrong, but the way I take it when I read that there's a fire in your stomach, I don't really think there's a fire. I mean, maybe I'm just speculating. I don't think there's actually like a fire going on in there with like a furnace and wood. Mm. But there is actually a fire in there where it's like there's a chemical reaction going on inside there, and there's heat. And anyway.
So yeah, there are technical descriptions that we can make about, and just as you've done, about the digestive process. But how is it that if someone under your fingernail gets ripped off, it's very painful, that same fingernail grows back to the same size and shape and everything perfectly to fit your finger? How does that happen?
But what's the cat?
Huh?
What's the catalyst? What's causing this to happen?
Yeah. Any of you guys shaved today? What's causing your hairs to grow? What is it? Say again?
The super soul prevalent.
Very good. Very good. Right, right, right.
Hair and nails. Yeah, the body's degrading, but there's two things that keep growing. It's hair and nails.
Okay. Why is that?
I don't know that.
Finally, we got to the inconceivable.
That one I don't know.
Well, these are some examples that Prabhupada gives, and they are things that at least you have to say that these are things which are involuntary. It's not that our thought process, that we have to think and will them to happen. They're happening automatically. And that's inconceivable in this world. What things happen on their own? Nature happens on its own. And these certain actions of our body happen on their own. They're already put in place. They're already programmed. They're already working. There's already an intelligence behind them. It's not within our conception or our construction that these things happen. And so these are examples of how things are inconceivable, even in our own body, that we can. And so if we can accept that it's going on in our own body, then we should be able to, as Arjuna took us, go to another step, a higher step, and understand there's some idea behind this, and there's a person behind it ultimately that's making it all happen. I think that's the point that we have to come to when we try to understand inconceivable. Because even though we give answers and we may be able to explain these things, there are other things that we simply can't explain. Even on the molecular level, science today has come to the level of breaking the universe down in so many ways, and when they get to the smallest particles, they cannot predict how they're going to move and how they're going to interact. So at a very, very basic level, there's uncertainty. That's pretty frightening, isn't it? That our whole world is based on unpredictability. And so basically that means our whole world is based on the inconceivable potency of the Lord. So if we get to know Him, as Vaishnava was saying, if we get to know Him, then we're going to be on firmer ground. Yes.
Like what I said earlier, it was based on some logic to accept Krishna consciousness, but I guess Prabhupada wasn't talking about that logic. He had a direct perception of Krishna through devotional service, and that gives him more confidence. Like what I'm saying is, I guess it's the starting point, but what Prabhupada was feeling is the like direct perception, which gives you more confidence that this is real, this is not, you're just believing.
Right. Yeah, that's correct. Now, What about when we're tested by this idea of inconceivability? Because that's something that can come into our lives individually. So we can talk sort of about the universal form and how that's inconceivable and sort of philosophically about inconceivability. But what about when it impacts our own lives in a very, very personal way? For instance, what do you do when, say, like Parasuram in the Bhagavatam? Parasuram was told by his father to kill his mother. Told him, kill her. And kill all your brothers too while you're at it, because they didn't listen to what I had to say. So, often, not often, but at least I think at some significant point in our lives, we're tested by the inconceivable Lord asking us to do something that really requires us to take a leap of faith, to act in ways in which that we're really uncertain about, that really test our faith in different ways, like this. Although I'm not sure it tested Parashuram's faith, because he actually acted very quickly. But, huh? Yeah, he did, yes. But let's put that in context. So let's not leave it hanging there, right? That's the whole point of the talk here. We're going to go through it. Well, there's a lot of things. Even in the Bible, Abraham was told to kill Isaac, right?
There's also the story of Job.
Job.
Mm-hmm. Who suffered the loss of absolutely everything, but he still praised God and loved God.
Right. So our faith in God at some point is going to bring us to test us. And so what is going to help us to pass that test if we accept that it's coming from an inconceivable source? I think that's the question. And so how do we approach that? It's a question that many philosophers and religionists have dealt with for centuries. And so what I want to do is I want to pass out a little chart to you. I only have six, so maybe send one, two. Okay, well, maybe you can pass them out. Leave this one for me. This is a chart that takes a look at reason and ethics. But let's just accept ethics as acting according to the order of God. If you're put in a situation where you're like Abraham, told to kill his son Isaac, or Parasuram, told to kill his mother, then how are you going to understand and justify what you do? These are six ways in which people have approached that historically. If you look at the box there at the convergence of supremacy of religion and strong version, you see fundamentalism. All morality, or in other words, acting, is based on divine commands from God in a fundamentalist way. And so, as portrayed in the modern media in America at least, Islam is portrayed as a fundamentalist religion. You know, jihad, kill all the infidels, right, in a fundamentalist way. So if they're told that, go and commit mayhem and murder in the name of Allah, then, and they do it, then they're accepting that inconceivable nature of the Lord in a fundamentalist way, without reasoning about it at all, and they may go and do anything in the name of God, of the inconceivable power of God. Quite honestly, I don't think that represents Krishna consciousness, so we don't have to worry about that one. If you go down to the next one, Kierkegaard says that when you get these kind of like inconceivable commands of the Lord, what you really need to do is like suspend your disbelief. In other words, act anyway on the Lord of Lords, just saying temporarily, well, okay, I don't understand this, but I'm going to put it on hold that I don't understand it, and I'm going to go ahead and act as the Lord wants. And then the results or the consequences will bear out that it was right to do that job. In other words, it's inconceivable to us, but we'll get an answer when we see the result at the end. We'll get the conceivability that way. Sometimes that's used by us. You know, Prabhupada says, actually, if you don't understand Bhagavad Gita, then at least theoretically accept. And then do your study, and at the end you'll come to the correct conclusions. So that one's used by us a bit. If we go up to Hegel, who's in the middle on the top there, he basically says that reason and religion are identical. In other words, the inconceivable command of the Lord is understandable by reason, and there's no difference between the two. Aquinas, below there, says religion and reason may be different, but ultimately they don't conflict. In other words, we may reason our way to a conclusion, or we may accept that the word of God, and they may appear different, but actually they're the same. Kind of inconceivable oneness and difference. then we have supremacy of religion, reason, where there's just atheistic, they don't accept at all the inconceivable nature of the Lord. That's Russell, Bertrand Russell, just completely atheistic or agnostic. And then below that, Immanuel Kant says that God is conceivable. If there's going to be a God, he has to be conceivable, and we can understand him by our reason. So these are different ways in which people have approached this subject of inconceivability when there's a personal test in their life. But which one would we resort to during a personal test in our life? Anybody, if you had a personal test in your life, how would you go about approaching that? Kalakanta?
One thing is an element of trust that if we have a relationship with a friend, our best friend, that he's not going to do something to hurt us.
That's very good. By developing a loving relationship, then we're more confident to act when we don't understand because we know this person. Mm-hmm. We know the person. Well, I know that person. If they're asking me to do that, then, you know, sure, I'll act, you know, based on that. That's very good. That's very good. Anyone else? Yes.
Is that how Parshuram acted on his father's order to kill his mother? Is because he had the trust in his father?
I think because he had trust and he also had knowledge. So trust or love, also knowledge. He had knowledge that his father had the mystic ability to reverse the situation. And that he knew that by pleasing him, if he asked him, he would. So a combination of things. He knew by his relationship that how he would react if he was pleased. And he knew that he had the power to do that, so therefore he could act. Yes?
No, I wasn't there, so...
Also, what about previous experiences? If you've already been through a lot, then you can probably go through more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, previous experiences. Previous experiences with God. And that's one reason why we read the scriptures, the Shastra, why we study the Shastras, to see the example of how others have, again, our whole thing is following behind others. So others have crossed through inconceivable difficulties in their lives. And when we come that in our life, and we follow their footsteps, we can also overcome that. So that's previous experiences there as well. Anything else anyone has? Okay. Well, I think we should all think about this because the inconceivable nature of the Lord does test us, and it will get to us at one point or another in our progress in Krishna consciousness. Because again, we have to come to actually understanding the position of the Lord. And it very fundamentally involves this inconceivability. Now, there's another aspect, and this is the final aspect of inconceivability that I want to relate to you, and that's sort of the culmination of coming to a complete understanding of the Lord's inconceivable nature. And that is that he uses his inconceivable nature not to just show off or prove that he's God, but to interact in a loving way with his devotees. There's a couple of examples this I'll leave you with. At the time when Lord Chaitanya and his devotees cleansed the Gunjita temple before Rath Yatra, you know, there's a whole ceremony where the devotees go to the temple and they clean it very much. After they finished that, Lord Chaitanya was so pleased by the endeavor of all the devotees that he got everybody together and he was serving them prasad. Everyone sat down and Lord Chaitanya was personally serving prasad. But then Swarup Damodar and the other devotees told Lord Chaitanya that, well, my dear Lord, no one else is going to eat unless you sit down and eat first. And so he said, no, I want to serve the devotees. No, sit down. So finally they convinced him to sit down. But what he did when he was sent down, he used his achintya shakti in a very loving way with his devotees. Because he's a super soul in everyone's heart, he could understand what everyone's favorite prasadam was. So then he was directing the servers, give Gopal some rasgulla. Give Andrea some... what's your favorite prasadam? Huh? Laddu. Give her some laddus. He was displaying his inconceivable nature, his inconceivable potency, knowing the devotees, knowing what they love, to exchange in loving relationship with them. Similarly, when the Lord lifted Govardhan Hill, his lifting Govardhan Hill wasn't just to show that, you know, I'm strong or, you know, whatever. But the reason why the real glory of lifting Govardhan Hill was is that all the residents of Vrindavan got a chance to be with Krishna 24 hours a day for 7 full days. Whereas in ordinary pastimes in Goloka Vrindavan, he goes off to the forest and he's away from Mother Yasoda. He's with the gopis, he's not with the cowherd boys. He's like that. They're separated from him. But during that leela, he got to... all the devotees got to interact with Krishna, and standing there lifting the hill and just glancing at all the devotees for a week at times, they all experienced their loving relationship with him in an inconceivable way. So that's how the Lord ultimately uses his potencies, is in loving pastimes with his devotees. Not that that's our ultimate conception of God, that he's just so strong or something like that, but that he interacts with his devotees in a loving way. So these are some thoughts about inconceivability. Obviously, we can't completely cover the subject, or otherwise it would be conceivable. But are there any questions anyone has? Yes, Andrew?
I have a friend of mine who just got initiated in India, and he's not... oh, I thought you said Luke. And
well, who is it that you might as well...
And he's trying to understand Krishna from a point of view of the gopis.
Mm.
And I wanted to know more about that, about why we shouldn't do that and why we should stick to what Prabhupada told us.
Mm. Well, I think it's that question could be answered on many different levels, but I think the most basic level is that Krishna and his intimate associates, his most intimate associates, are the gopis. Now, you can't understand anyone by immediately, without any introduction, without any knowledge of them, without showing some kind of sincerity, you can't immediately go to the intimate circle of anyone. You can't even go to the intimate circle of, you know, maybe some of us in this room. Because, well, I don't know you. I mean, you're a devotee and everything, but fine. But, certain levels are there. Why then do we think that we should be able to immediately go to the innermost, most confidential association of Krishna and understand him from that level? Rather, our acharyas have told us that Gopi Bharta Pada Kamalayor Dasa 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 Anudas, that the best way to approach is to consider yourself the servant, the servant, the servant, the servant, 1,000 times removed, starting there. That way you can actually understand Krishna. And that same instruction comes in many ways by Srila Prabhupada. He says, just like the Srimad Bhagavatam or any book, you know, say some of your etymology books, are you going to be able to understand the last chapter without studying the previous chapters? No. And so Prabhupada has told us, 10th canto is where Krishna's pastimes with the gopis are explained, but there are 9 cantos before that. Study the 9 cantos before so that you'll have the qualification to understand that chapter when you get there. But if you want to immediately jump there, then it's going to be hard to understand. And so those are certain reasons, and I think that they are etiquette, they're personalism, they're based on ability to understand, using even reason and logic. All these things dictate to us approaching Krishna in a way that's not so fresh, as you might say. You know, oh, this is a fresh person. They just want to like think they can know anything so intimately quickly. That's not the way our acharyas have taught us to respect Krishna and approach him. So, and beside the fact that if we follow acharyas like Srila Prabhupada, like he made that statement that I'm convinced. It's not a question of belief, but I'm convinced. It's a fact. If we can just have that kind of conviction, then, you know, we'll quickly get to the association of Radha and Krishna. Okay?